Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone I've always wanted to meet and have a conversation with, from the band Heat Miser, Neil Gust is on the show today, and this is a conversation I'm really happy I got to have. More on that in one second, but first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. We also have a Instagram page, a TikTok page, a YouTube page, and a Facebook page for this podcast, all of which can be found at Turned Out a Punk on their respective platforms. If you're looking for me, I'm on Twitter or X at Left4Damian. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let everyone know that we do this podcast each and every week, twice a week now. I think we're going back to twice a week. And it's all over the map. We talk about punk from all sorts of different vantage points and different definitions of it, and we get into it. Speaking of getting into it, get into the band I play in. That's a very weird way of saying it, but we are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. We are fresh off a tour with The Damned, going to Europe. We got records over there and more information, and you can find it all over there at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top on the show today, from the band Heat Miser, the great Neil Gust is on the show. Now, Heat Miser is a band that I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with because of the association with former member Elliot Smith. But don't discredit Heat Miser and just, you know, look at it as being this band that Elliot Smith was in, because Heat Miser is fucking incredible. This is a band that I think it's overshadowed by, you know, everything that kind of came after it. These are awesome songs. This band has been good the whole way through. Every record is worth diving into. Really, in researching this episode, I went back and I listened to a lot of stuff, some of the records I hadn't listened to in a long time. And I was like, oh my gosh, how is this band not talked about way more? Well, maybe that'll change now, because Third Man Records, our buddies over there at Third Man Records, have seen it fit to reissue kind of like a greatest hits compilation with some unreleased stuff. It's called The Music of Heat Miser. It is out now. You can pick it up anywhere and everywhere. And so they're a band that outside of being a fan of, I didn't really know too much about the inner workings of. And oh my gosh, are you in for a treat with this episode? We talk about a lot of stuff. This is a really great conversation with someone who I've always wanted to have this kind of conversation with, someone who I've always wanted to sit down and talk to about not just this band, but this band's place in punk history and just what it's like to have a friend, a creative partner that kind of gets taken away, subsumed into a larger world and becomes, the property in a lot of ways of the world at large, and you lose touch with who your friend was. We explain it and get into it a lot more deeply on the episode itself. I'm kind of searching for the words here to sum it all up. So you're going to have to listen to the whole conversation. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. I'm going to tell you, check out the Music of Heat Miser compilation. Check out all the stuff. Check out Number Two, Neil's band afterwards, a band that links up all these disparate scenes. Once again, we talk about this in a second, so I'm not going to ramble on and force you to listen to it twice. But check out both those bands. They are fantastic. And that is it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Neil Gust on Turned Out a Punk. Neil, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It has been an adventure and a half so far trying to get you on the air because of my Mac problems, but yeah. I appreciate your patience, and I'm very excited to talk to you because there's like so much nerdy stuff for me to dig in with you
about. Awesome. I can't wait to talk about music with you too.
Well, this is a big thrill for me because I've been a fan of the band for a long time, and I feel like
it's a fascinating band because it links a lot of different worlds of kind of Portland music. And I think Portland is a very, because of Seattle, I think it's a very underappreciated scene during that time period.
Yeah, it's really different. It was different.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to get into that, but we got to start off the way they all start off, which is, Neil, how'd you get into punk from the first time you ever came across it?
Well, I grew up in Iowa City, and the first, you know, it was probably local band. There was this, like, there was a big punk scene, but I wasn't really part of it. Like, I was super into REM, and I'd grown up listening to, like, Led Zeppelin. I have older brothers and cousins that lived in Chicago who, like, saw everybody. They saw Ramones, The Clash, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, everything. But and I was much younger than them. So the first punk band I probably saw was probably an Iowa band called Iowa Beef Experience.
Great band.
Yeah. And they were playing we were playing with them, with my high school band, and another band called Stick Dog was playing, and they were really weird. They were like industrial, and they had like big sheets of metal that they were like rattling. And then there was another Iowa City band called Red Throb that I remember being really good.
It's interesting you brought up Iowa Beef Experience, because like there's a there's kind of this like noise rock thing, and like you wind up doing records on Cavity Search Records, which had Atomic 61 on it too. And yeah, I kind of that scene too, where it's like this sort of like really cool Pan American like noise rock scene, like AMREP Records and it's Art Damage punk scene.
Yeah. I mean, this was way before AMREP. That's, but it was like, like the guy in Iowa Beef Experience I went to high school with, and he was older than me, and he worked at the school newspaper, which is where all the punk rockers worked. And they took classes for the school newspaper, and they would write about punk rock shows, and nobody in the school wanted to read about them except like four people. And I was one of them. And I remember them writing about Husker Du. I found out about Husker Du from my school newspaper.
Well,
so it was probably around like Metal Circus or something like that. So it there was always this little corner of weirdos in Iowa City.
Yeah, it feels like every school, unless it's like one of those weird schools that had a massive punk scene,
right?
Always had like a clique of weird kids that would wind up not necessarily all into punk, but would all kind of have to group together because there's strength in numbers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
What was your early high school band like? Like it was REM kind of vibe?
So I was in a couple high school bands, and we only ever played like maybe two shows a year. And we would practice for months and months and months and months and then play the show. And it was very, like, the first band I was in was mostly covers, and we didn't even have a singer. So it was, I can't even remember what we played. I remember one song was by Rush, and it took me months to learn it. And then the second band I was in was more original, and REM was, I was in love with REM. I couldn't get enough of them, and it wasn't so much the like jangly music as it was, I loved the way that they conducted their band, you know, like they were all in it together, and the stuff they put out looked so cool and mysterious, and you couldn't tell what he was fucking singing, and it was just, there was so much to dig into, and that's what I loved. So I was trying to imitate that kind of thing. So I'd make these really weird homoerotic posters and put them up all over school. And I was totally in the closet. And I remember one of the guys in my band was like, dude, why are you putting all these suave looking guys on the poster? And it was face turned completely red and I had to make up some excuse for it.
It's interesting when you look at the effect REM had, and I think now it's being, there's that Capture Tracks box set that came out a couple years ago, like Jangle Pop, I forget what it's called. But there is a sort of like massive reverberation caused by that band. And I consider them a band that 100% comes out of punk.
Yeah, totally. But they were also like a gateway, you know, they were total gateway drug band. And eventually I found, you know, a whole world of music that I didn't even know about.
It's interesting who too, when you look at like REM as being this sort of like one version of what a, you know, like, an, I guess, quote unquote, independent band can kind of operate as, or like, you know, obviously IRS, but like, you know, like that kind of world of band. And then the other polarity happening at the same time, kind of diametrically opposed to it, is Butthole Surfers.
Right.
The Iowa Beef Experience would be a band that's kind of gravitating to that whole world a little bit more.
Yeah. But yeah.
But it does kind of come together in a weird way later on in Portland. Like, you do see these kind of merging of these two kind of extremes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
What about when you went to Boston? Like, what was it for you leaving Iowa and heading out there?
So I wasn't in Boston. I went to school at Hampshire, which was in Amherst, Massachusetts, but I had friends that lived in Boston, and Boston was terrifying. I still find it to be one of the meanest places in the country. People are mean there, but it was fun to go to Boston. I think that's when I got to see the Replacements, and I don't remember if I ever did get to see any other bands there. But at school, it's like we arrived at Hampshire right after all the great bands had just played there. So like Bad Brains had just played and Nirvana had just played, and we missed it. I got to see Soundgarden there. I saw the Flaming Lips really early on. But that's it. That's all I can think of.
It's interesting too, because like Amherst does have a really distinct scene from Boston. Like, geographically, they're not that close. I just, in my Canadian geography, of American geography sense, I'm like, oh, they're like right on top of each other.
Right. So the big scene in Amherst was Dinosaur. It was before they were Dinosaur Jr. And then there was a great local band called Gobblehoof. And I think that's where Elliot and I first like stood in a room with someone playing through a Marshall. And that had a big effect on both of us. Like, it sounded so great and heavy and amazing.
Yeah, did Gobblehoof put out any records? I'm trying to think if I've
I don't ever... know. I don't know if they did. They, you know, like we, I just saw them on campus, but they weren't from Hampshire. So
they just, I'd say.
Yeah. They were really good.
What about Bullet La Travolta? Like, I guess they were kind of happy.
Yeah, I never saw them. But I had friends that went and saw them. My buddy Mark Swanson, who worked in dance clubs in Boston, saw everybody, and so he would come back and tell me about all this stuff. So Pixies were happening too, and that was a big deal.
Did they ever come and play the Pixies?
They might have. I never saw them.
It's interesting, because then it's like almost like you guys are developing your own musical universe a little bit, like taking all this stuff in, but not necessarily affected by a scene at the same time, because you're playing in bands in college too, right?
Yeah. Yes. The stuff that it was more just the stuff that came close by. So we saw Fugazi, and who else came? Jane's Addiction. a really terrible Jane's Addiction show, but Fugazi was mind-blowing and life-changing, you know. I can't remember anything else. I'm sorry, I've forgotten so much of this stuff.
Oh, don't worry. This is like a brain X-lax. So what was so terrible about the Jane's Addiction show?
They just, it sounded bad. Like, I don't think they sound checked or anything. And I think they were high, and, or at least someone was high. It was just weird. Cause we loved Nothing Shocking and listened to it constantly. And then when we went to see it, it was so underwhelming. I'm sure other shows they played were incredible, you know, like I wish I got to see that, but boy, not this one. We saw one of the bad ones.
It's weird how, like, I almost forget that Jane's Addiction and Fugazi existed in the same universe.
Right?
Weird.
Yeah.
I've never put them side by side till you just brought them up side by side like that, but they do have an interesting sonic similarity, like totally different approaches, but like the quest for rhythm within rock and roll.
Yeah, they're experimental and inventive and weird and heavy and, you know, great bands. But Fugazi, we just definitely went towards, found a much deeper emotional, personal connection with Fugazi.
Well, like, not to jump ahead, because this we'll probably get to eventually, but like, you know, later on when the Virgin deal comes up and it's time to like sign to a major label, was that Fugazi damage that so many of us have part of like that thought process for you guys? Like, what does it mean to sign to a major label? Like, what does it mean to not be, you know, this kind of like perfect model of what a band should be that Fugazi puts forth?
Yeah, there was definitely like concern about what it meant to sign to a major label and who these labels were and what it, you know, what tribe we were aligning with and all that stuff mattered a lot to us. That what the way that it manifested for us was that we didn't have a signed deal with Frontier until we actually signed with Virgin. And so the day that we signed on Virgin was the day we signed our Frontier contract. And both contracts were very bad for the band. But we, you know, we were held together by momentum. And if we'd stopped to like fight about fairness in contracts, we would never have made more records together.
I think it's interesting because not everyone in the band signs the contract with the major label even, right?
Me and Elliot and Tony signed.
Yeah.
And that's all that the band was at the time. And Sam Coombs, who plays bass, he was like, I'm just the hired hand, even though he totally was the bass player. But yeah, that was it that signed.
I think I've even heard him in an interview that he didn't want to sign to the contract, worrying that it was going to screw up with the other stuff he had. And it's funny. It's these contracts that bands were signing, especially in the wake of Nirvana, which is like sort of this massive rush on independent bands. A lot of them were super predatory.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, knowing what I know now and having put out, you know, three records in independent labels after that, it's, you know, and understanding like basic fairness about it, it's absurd the way those deals worked in the past, but you know, that's how it was.
It's also, I found interesting that the vinyl comes out on Cavity Search Records for the last LP and not on Frontier. Like, was that a conscious thing? Did you have to carve that out in the contract, being like, no, our friends are
gonna play? I don't remember. Like, we've been putting out singles with Cavity Search, and we've made three. They put out a single right before Mike City Sons of two songs that aren't on that record. And then we just got them the vinyl rights. They, you know, it was really limited. They could only make 1,000 of them. So I don't, at the time, I think like our relationship with Frontier wasn't that great, and there wasn't a lot of trust, and I don't know why we didn't have them put out the vinyl. I have no idea.
Like, and also, like, why did they have to get signed? Like, this is just probably way in the weeds, but like, why would they have to get signed in on, or a piece of you going forward on, you know, Virgin?
Frontier?
Yeah.
Good question.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. that had really, like, serious repercussions for Elliot, because, like, Frontier ended up getting a piece of DreamWorks deal with Elliot, and that wasn't fair. But you know,
did they get a piece of number two too?
No, I was like done. Like, I sent Virgin a tape of new songs, and they were like, you know, we've got the Spice Girls now, and this is really what we would like to concentrate on. It's like, okay. And so I was free. And once that deal ended, there was nothing tying me to anything else. So, yeah, number two has always been, we've owned our master tapes and just find whatever label wants to work with us.
It wasn't until much later that I really understood that Caroline was kind of like the AAA team for Virgin. That it's like all those like Smashing Pumpkins, quote unquote, independent records were actually like part of the deal, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't, when we signed with Virgin, it wasn't like we knew our record was coming out on Caroline. It was more when we finally finished the record, there, you know, we, Heat Miser didn't have a booking agent, and we were going to tour, but there was no machinery in place to like promote the record, and they just kicked it down to Caroline as a way of like cutting their losses.
But it's interesting because like I imagine around that time also Elliot is, you know, heating up like that either
for sure,
or, you know, and stuff. So it's interesting that it wasn't more of a priority for them.
Yeah, everyone just shifted their before Heat Miser was even done making Mike City Sons, the focus with, you know, with the business side of people, and the audience was just towards Elliot. So Heat Miser wasn't really a priority except for the people in the band. We wanted to make a really good record. And so it was a weird, weird thing, a weird experience. And when it was done, I was like, man, I got to leave that behind.
It's interesting because you must have been over it, because by the time number two starts, it's like a completely different vibe of a band and seems like it's operating almost in a different kind of world.
It was certainly back to being totally independent, and there, yeah, it was, for me, number two felt like freedom. You know, the first number two record was a very freeing experience and great. The second number two record was where I kind of confronted the fact that I couldn't make a living doing it. You know, mm-hmm. So that was very different than Heat Miser, which felt like maybe we are going to make a living doing this.
We've jumped way ahead, and hopefully come back to this, because I got to go back to when you get to Portland. What was it that drew you to Portland over any of the other kind of cities happening? Because like in a pre-Nirvana world, it's not like the Northwest was the destination.
Right. So, well, Elliot was from Portland, mm-hmm. and he knew Tony Lash, the drummer in Heat Miser. He'd gone to school with Tony. They'd been playing, recording together during the summers while we were going to college. And when Elliot and I first decided that we were going to be in a band after we graduated from school, the first thought was, let's move to Chicago. And it was sort of like, what would be exciting? And then we thought, maybe Chicago. So for a while, we thought that's where we were going to go. And then Elliot was like, what about playing with my friend Tony? He sounds like the drummer in the Pixies. Like he's that precise. And so it was like, okay, that, you know, we had no other plan other than to just try to be in a band, move to some place and do it. And you know, that was a fortunate choice.
It's interesting now looking at Portland, you know, in a post-Portlandia world versus Portland back then, because it's kind of a harder city.
Back then or now?
Back then.
Well, yeah, it was great. You could be an artist there, you know, like it was cheap. And there was a lot of young people making stuff, and it was competitive. And but it was also stimulating, you know. There were writers and artists and tons of musicians making bands, doing all kinds of stuff, like a vast spectrum of music that's not just like Pacific Northwest grunge rock. And that was really thrilling.
Well, yeah, I think that's spoken to by the fact that when you arrive, well, I guess not after when you arrive, but when you start doing the LPs, you end up working with the Slayer hippie, which is so sick.
Right. So Tony had, Tony was developing himself into a record producer, and he had produced the Poison Idea record. I can't remember, it's like Feel the Darkness, I think it was. And that's how he knew Slayer, Steve Hanford. And when it came time to making a record properly, he was like, we should bring in Steve. He's really good in the studio, but I'm kind of nervous because, you know, you guys might not like him because he's a handful. And like the second we met him, everybody loved him because he was so funny. And he was so funny and really talented, but also a complete wild card.
It's a band of wild cards.
Yeah.
Poison Ivy. Had you seen them?
I did. I saw them in it. Like, I didn't see them in their heyday when, you know, they must have been terrifying. I saw them towards the end.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, Feel the Darkness is one of my favorite records of all time. Like, I think that thing is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that, you know, like the same time they're kind of winding down and you're there, like you guys are playing, there's also like Resist playing at the same time. And there's like Quasi, there's Team Dretch. There's like, were the Wipers still going?
No, they unfortunately were not. But so I never got to see the Wipers.
Was Greg Sage still playing around solo at that point? Because that cough.
No, I think he lived in Arizona or something. Oh. I don't know. When I found out about the Wipers, I was like, how have I gotten this far without knowing about the Wipers? You know, like these are great. This is great. And he's gay. Like, how did I not know? But, you know, it's one of those things. I'm just glad that those records had legs, you know, and that people still find out about them because they're amazing.
Yeah, they're some of the greatest American rock records ever. And then, like, yeah, you're saying, like, the fact that they're even still now this obscure, like, this band is up there with the Replacements and Husker Du in terms of what, like, so you arrived like 1991, right? Or is it
1991?
had Nirvana happened yet, or it's just about to happen type thing?
Yeah, it had just come out. So we arrived in the spring of 91, at like May of 91. And I got Nevermind in Portland. And it, at the same time, like Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 had just come out, and like Actung Baby by U2, and the Metallica record with Enter Sandman. It all, like, all these records came out the same summer. And when Nirvana came out, like, we were meeting people who were just kind of like stunned. They were because it hadn't fully blown up yet, but you could tell, like, it was just about to. And so many people had lived with that band and knew them, and it was just part of like the local fiber, you know. And to have that suddenly become the dominant cultural force was disorienting.
Yeah, like, you really get that sense when you talk to people from there. Like, the relationship to Nirvana from people that were there at the time, I find so fascinating. From people that never got it, to people that were like, this is my favorite local band and felt like they had lost it, or you know, people friends with them. You guys are kind of in the same circle that they're in.
I mean, we weren't. I eventually, you know, we became connected with people who knew them well, but it, when we first arrived, we didn't really know anybody. The Elliot's friends were high school friends who, I don't remember meeting any of his old friends from high school when we arrived in Portland. It really felt like we were starting over and had to meet all new friends. And, you know, besides Tony.
Who were some of the local bands kind of happening around them that you fell in with?
Cracker Bash was one of the more memorable ones. And there's a band called Pond that they just gotten signed to Sub Pop, I think. And there's a band called Sprinkler. And then eventually there's a band called Hazel, that were sort of in the first year of Pete Miser actually playing. They all had much bigger audiences than we did, but we were trying to get shows with them. And so, but there's so many Portland bands. Oh my God. Those are the ones that I remember because I'm still friends with people in those bands. But like the ones I didn't know as well, there was like Hitting Birth, which was this sort of tribal experience. And oh boy, I'm not gonna remember all the Calamity Jane. There's so many to remember, and I'm drawing a blank.
Well, because you're right, it is such a prolific, well, I guess it's scenes, you know, like the fact that there's all these like different interpretations of what American underground music is,
yeah,
happening at the same time. And a lot of that nuance, I think, gets lost when people look back at that time, because they kind of focus just on, like, as you brought up earlier, the grunge thing that was kind of happening. And it maybe was the most dominant in the mainstream, but what wasn't the most dominant on the independent scene?
For sure not. I mean, especially like in Portland, there'd be bands that nobody had heard of outside of Portland, but in Portland, when they played, they'd sell out, you know. They had huge followings.
What made you, sorry, how long after you guys arrived did you do that first demo tape?
So the demo tape was recorded in 92, and over it was like 2 months after we played our first show, when we recorded the demo. So it was Sometime in mid 92. I you know, it's written down on the liner notes in the album. I don't have them in front of me. And then we went back into the studio a few months later and recorded some more stuff, just demoing, because I think by then Frontier wanted to hear more. So we recorded a bunch of stuff.
So were those songs that you had from college that you were kind of saving?
So some of it had been developed in college, but we wrote a lot really fast. And some of the stuff ended up being from there, but a lot of it really started to happen once we were playing with Tony and Brant, because it you know, we could feel what it was going to be like.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
And what made you kind of approach Frontier? Was there like other labels you're looking at? Because it's like a very story.
We would have taken anything, you know, like Frontier showed interest. So we were like, okay, you know, it was weird. Like there were the labels that were around that time. So Sub Pop was at the very top. And then there was another Seattle label called CZ, I think.
Absolutely.
And there was Empty and Imp Records. There was trying to think of other stuff. There was TK Records, which was in Portland. They were putting out Poison Idea. They put out Sprinkler, a Sprinkler 7-inch. But we couldn't get any. They didn't give a shit, you know, like the Pacific Northwest was awash in rock bands, you know, like it was so many bands that to stand out was difficult. And Frontier, we hooked up with Frontier through the Dharma Bums, who had made like three records with Frontier. And we got Lisa Fancher, who runs Frontier, this cassette, and she had it for a while and finally stuck it on in her car tape deck and was like, yeah, okay. And as soon as somebody showed an interest, and we were like, she put out the Circle Jerks, like, okay, we'll do that. Like that Suicidal Tendencies, Thin White Rope, you know, like, great. So we were off. As soon as somebody showed an interest, we weren't picky.
Well, yeah, because like a shitty deal aside, it is one of those very storied American labels. Like, yeah, for yourself, like, as you said, going back, Suicidal Tendencies and Circle Jerks. And then, you know, they put out weird stuff all in between too. It's like, Lisa does have a really good ear for picking out these things that will resonate for a long time. Like a lot of these bands are.
Right. She had Flop from Seattle, and they were really awesome and the nicest guys. I remember loving that first record of theirs. Very poppy.
Fantastic band. So I guess, around that same time, when you arrived there, I guess there's also like fits of depression happening. Uh-huh. Were they a band that you played with at all, or?
Maybe. I don't remember. Played with a lot of bands. I remember the name. We didn't play. Were they on K?
I think they might have been on K.
So we didn't play with a lot of K bands. They didn't. They like the Tribe was weird. Like it wasn't. It really wasn't until later, when Elliot was putting out records by himself, and when Number Two was on Chainsaw, that it felt like, you know, K style bands would want to play with us.
But also, is it the sound changing too, I guess, with the band? Like, you know, like at first you're like a heavier band.
Right. Yeah. I mean, at the time, it was hard to distinguish us from other bands. I think in retrospect, if you listen, it's the records sound great, you know, like it. If you're not awash in all of it, you can hear what's good about it. But at the time, boy, there was just so many guitar bands.
Did you get much touring on those early records? I know you tour a national tour later on.
Yeah, we did. I think 3 national tours and then several West Coast tours. Never did anything in Europe. But the first 2 Heat Miser tours were entirely put together, entirely booked by our manager, who was JJ Gonson, who was also Elliot's girlfriend. She just sat at home and called places up, cold called, and put it together. And those tours were, they were hard, but they were pretty good. And then we finally got a booking agent, and that tour fell apart really fast because just it was so badly organized. And we'd show up and nobody would be there. And it was weird. Like, this is our 3rd tour. We put out 2 records. Where, how come nobody's here? It was weird. And then, actually, then we did one more for Mike's 80 Sons after that. But
was she used? She's probably using Book Your Own Fucking Life, right? That Max Rock and Roll probably. Resource book it. Yeah, because it's interesting. Like when you're relying on like a quote unquote punk kid to do your shows, you know, they're going to bring their friends out. They're going to put like a little bit of effort into it. Right. Because it's like, you know, but also could be a complete disaster. It's either going to go one of 2 ways when it's a punk kid.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. And you would find, and on those tours, they were amazing because like one night would be whoever happened to be in the bar. And then the next night, Kalamazoo, there's 120 people here and they all know the record. And it's like the greatest show you've played in months. And then the next night, it's like whoever is at the bar, you know.
I think it's changed now, but there's almost this thing that happens when, you know, kind of like a beloved, you know, once again, to use punk as a shorthand band, kind of tries to level up or naturally just winds up leveling up, where there's like, you know, like there's like a retraction in the audience because the people that kind of held you close as their band feel the they don't feel that same sort of ownership, it seems. And I see personally who's been through it.
Do you feel like that still happens?
I think it's happening less, you know, like, it seems like the idea of selling out is very quaint now, because like we're all on Spotify. Like we're all playing the same game now.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking to Sam Coombs. The Quasi was touring the East Coast, and we were talking about how music fans are that you how much of a you draw your community from what you listen to, you know, and it used to be much more tribal, and now because maybe because of streaming and social media, it must be because of that. There's less of a it's less grouped. So the more, you know, I don't just belong to, you know, Tribe Radiohead or whatever, you know, like I also listen to Afrobeat and I like Taylor Swift or whatever, you know, you can have a much more wide interest and still and not be shut down by your friends, you know? Yeah. So it maybe that's why if like a band tries to level up, it doesn't feel like a betrayal of that community, of your little tiny community.
Yeah, I think there was an economic component to it back then. Like you could only afford to buy so many records. You could only participate. Right.
Totally. I mean, the people that think that people complain about with vinyl, that it's expensive and is, you know, it's a hassle, that's actually what makes it good. Because if it's expensive, you're investing in it. And if it's a hassle, you have to put time into it. And if you do those things, you end up getting more out of it rather than just having something that's like, you know, streaming in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. There's almost like a religious adherence back then because there was a tithing that you had to do to, you know, you had to pay to the Church of Discord and Ian MacKaye.
Yeah.
And the fun records or going to the shows and like,
yeah,
that was your religion. So you were going to defend it against the Church of Bad Religion or whatever.
Right. Exactly.
And I guess it speaks to what you were saying before about K Records and that other kind of parallel scene that are like, now in today's world, they're like on top of each other. But back then, right, it's a gulf. Oh,
it was distinct from each other. Yes.
It's interesting how it's changed and like what's caused that change to happen. Like, as you're saying, it is this sort of like exposure to all sorts of different sorts of music. You know, but I think it's also like we've had this sort of shift where like the culture's gone from being like, well, it's just gone to mainstream culture. Like now there's almost like this sort of like religious devotion to the celebrities in the way that we kind of had in punk rock back then, where you have, you know, like these certain celebrities elevated to deities.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird.
I walked through the mall yesterday, early the other day, and there was just like every single person in a Nirvana shirt, every single store had a Nirvana shirt.
Isn't that the weirdest thing? I don't know what to make of it.
I know Kurt probably wouldn't be stoked.
For sure not. But I mean, I'm also happy those guys make money. Like if you can make money doing this, then more power to you. It's so hard.
Yeah. I think there's like stratospheres now of money too. Cause yeah. I think that they're doing pretty good. Well, if they're getting a piece of every one of those shirts, they're definitely doing pretty good.
Yeah.
When it does come to sign to Virgin and everything like that, was there resistance from people that you knew? Like, were there people telling you kind of like, this isn't something you'd want to do? Or like, is there, because there is still that major indie, like religious adherence back then.
No, I didn't feel that at all. I think most bands at the time were, everybody wanted to level up, you know, and get better and make cooler records. And we really wanted to like build our own studio and spend time recording and not be on the clock, studio clock. And the only way to do that is to get someone to invest in us, and so that we could buy all the gear, which is what we did. So I didn't feel any of that resistance. There was resistance from, like, from Elliot's solo world, where they, you know, it was taking energy away from that, and there was just this kind of weird, unspoken, unclear vibe that, you know, maybe this wasn't going to happen, or it was going to happen, but how was it going to happen, and what did it mean? And there were a lot of unanswered questions, and mostly we just didn't talk about it because we were in our 20s and not very good at communication.
Yeah, because I guess that Kill Rock Stars, K Records, it's a lot closer to the Nirvana thing. And it's like a lot of these people were part of that circle.
Yeah.
So I imagine they would have had a lot more resistance to the idea of this thing happening.
No, I don't think that's... I don't know. Because I didn't know... I didn't know Slim very well, from Slim Moon from Kill Rock Stars. And I... stuff that Elliot was doing and going through, like, it was separate from what Heat Miser was going through, and we weren't living together at the time. So, you know, I don't know what it was like for him to sign to a major label with his band, and if he took any flack for it. What I do know is that, like, his manager and publishing, they wanted to level Elliot up, and they were definitely going to go to a major label. They just didn't know if they wanted it to be Virgin on his band. So I have no idea, though. Like I said, it was a feeling. It was so long ago that I don't remember the facts. I just remember the vibe and the feeling. And I remember it feeling like there wasn't stability, and not really understanding why. Because Elliot wasn't saying, I don't want to do this. He was saying, I want to make a great Heat Miser record. So, okay, like, let's do it. And how we got there was, you know, just a matter of working it out. But we didn't talk. We didn't communicate very well.
I've heard you talk about almost a lack of confidence that you had by the end of recording versus the beginning of that recording session.
For sure. I was really isolated. we built this recording studio in a house that was in walking distance from where I lived in Portland. It was so cool. Like, we finally made the thing that we wanted to make. But I was just going there by myself. And Tony was off producing records, and Elliot was touring by himself, and Sam, you know, he would come in and mess around with me when he could, but he had a job working at Kinko's, and his focus was also to start Quasi. So I would go in there by myself and just kind of not know what to do. I'd be reading manuals for how to work a compressor. Like, I didn't know how to work a compressor. So just would learn and then mess around and then kind of not have any feedback or the, you know, the bouncing off of my collaborators. It really wasn't until we started playing together that, and having the band respond to the work we were doing together, that I started getting my confidence. But it was a hard thing to make, mainly because the poor communication and the feeling of isolation.
Well, yeah, it must have been so bizarre for you, because, like, here you are at, like, the end game of a band, or like the beginning of the career for the band, and, like, this is all you'd worked for, and then at the same time, it, like, it's by yourself.
Yeah, it didn't feel like it was the beginning. Like, that's exactly it. You hit the nail on the head.
It's a fantastic record, though. Like, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, it really does. I went back and re-listened to it today, and I'm like, damn, this thing is fucking awesome.
You're a sweetheart. Thank you very much.
But I guess, like, and also it's interesting because, like, you arrive in the Pacific Northwest, and you're kind of like, as you say, you're in these circles a little bit more later on, but around these circles when everything's happening in Nirvana. And then what happens with Elliot's kind of, it's different, but it's sort of the same sort of energy where what yeah. belongs to you very directly is being taken by other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah. I can only imagine what that's like to deal with. Like, I can't imagine what it's like to deal with.
It was a weird emotional time. I don't know which part of it to delve into with you, but it's, it was strange to feel so isolated when it shouldn't have been like that.
Well, yeah, because it just seems like there's a simpatico between the two worlds. And I imagine, like, you could see that. And it's just, but I guess there's other forces, like you mentioned. By this point, it's gone from being a band member and a friend to being a resource for somebody, or a commodity for someone.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I guess moving on, like, when number two started, as we talked about before, that's like a complete rejection of this feeling in this world. Like, how long did it take you from kind of the end of He Miser before you were ready to kind of do this again?
I was ready to go. Like, I had songs and, you know, ended up demoing using some of the, He Miser breaks up, and we start selling off all of the recording equipment that we'd bought. But we still had some, while we still had some of it, we had it in our apartment. And I lived in this house. I lived in the top with a roommate, and Elliot lived downstairs with a roommate. And we would demo using our gear. And I demoed a bunch of stuff for number two with Elliot. This is before I even had a band. And so Elliot would play drums and help, you know, run the board and everything like that. And it was really once I found Paul and Gilly and started going back and recording it, like, piece by piece. Anytime we had enough money to record, we just kind of gathered up enough songs until we had a record. And then, so there was about 3 years, 97 to 99. We put out the record in 99. So it took about 2 years to get that happening.
I didn't realize that Gilly was also in Consolidated.
Yeah. Yeah, she played. Yeah, she's been in a lot of bands.
It's fascinating with Consolidated because that band was so big and so important, and it feels like that's completely lost. Like, it hasn't had that cultural reassessment yet.
Yeah, maybe it's about time to go back.
We're starting it today,
right?
Yeah. Well, that's all. Like, what they're saying isn't relevant today. Like, it's maybe more sadly relevant and pressing that people say it now than even back then, it seems.
Maybe. I'm going to have to listen after we hang up, and I haven't listened to Consolidated since they were playing.
I'd be lying if I said I've been listening to a lot of Consolidated lately too, but I think I'm going to have to go back and listen to it as well. It's interesting when you do something out of kind of like the rock milieu, I guess, like it just ages differently. And, you know, like, there is a band that I wonder if it's going to have the same impact sonically that it would have at the time now.
Do you ever have the urge to do that?
Like, musically, me try and make stuff?
Yeah.
I recently have. I did a record with some friends that's like a drum and bass record, but my vocal ability is very limited. So what you see is what you get style wise with me. So it's more like they're choosing to put my very loud coat of paint into their painting.
And was it, what it feel like? What did you like it?
I loved it. It feels though, you know, like very disarming, because I think there's a safety in punk and hardcore, certainly with the style of music, where like punk and hardcore is like the only thing where you don't need to worry about virtue, being a lead singer in a punk hardcore band. This is the only thing you don't need to worry about virtuosity, because it's all about just emotion. You don't have to worry about pitch, key, rhythm. You just got to go out there and express yourself, and then just finally have to start considering other factors in the music. It's like, oh wow, I'm not as good at this as I thought it was.
Yeah, but punk can be anything. It's just like that. It's punk is a destructive force, right? Like that's the thrill of the destructive force, and you're just laying waste. And that, I mean, at least that's what is thrilling about punk to me. And taking that into any style of music is rad.
I definitely feel that too. I feel like, and that's the thing that's amazing, is because everyone's going to have a different interpretation of what that destructive force is. And it could be, you know, REM rejecting the toughness and the sort of like macho machismo in a lot of the rock, you know, or it could be Consolidated, or it could be what Psycom is, the pre-Jane's Addiction band. I think that was the punk band, and you know, Butthole Surfers or Fugazi. It could be anything.
Yeah.
But like, you do tend to get bogged down in your own interpretation of that, and then it tends to limit it. Like, I find that with a lot of people that come on the show, is that there's the version that was even not even chosen by them, sometimes imposed on them by the people around them. And that's the version you kind of take with you.
Yeah, I can understand that, especially if music is your community, you know, like you don't. Being part of the community is what feels so good about it. And if it, you know, you start breaking the rules of it and get rejected by your community, then it feels bad.
It feels
but
terrible.
That's what punk is for, you know, like it's for blowing holes in things, you know, like it's an important force.
Well, like you're saying, like, I think, you know, if we go with this maybe overblown metaphor of punk being a religion, or culture being a religion, to get rejected by your church, to get cast out of your faith is, you know, it's so destructive. Like, look at people that get cast out of their religion, and it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. Well, then that's when people start new religions.
Yes. Yeah. But you have to be a certain strong enough type of personality type to be able to start your own religion. Like,
yeah.
Times it's hard to kind of lick the wounds and kind of keep, you know, like you lose your confidence, and once you lose your confidence, you can't fly anymore.
Right. Yep.
That's what it all depends on, right? Like believing in yourself, and
absolutely. To me, rock music is all about confidence, and when you lose it, it's like what the fuck do you do, you know? But like, interesting things can come of that, because you have to kind of wander around until you can get airborne again, you know? Like it leads to new things. So I don't know, to all the punks out there, just keep doing, you know, don't lose hope.
Keep the faith. Speaking of community, you wind up on Chainsaw Records with Number Two. What a label.
Amazing.
Incredible, the roster that was on there. And
yeah.
Was that like kind of a scene? Like, were you playing with Sleater-Kinney, and were you playing with some of the other bands on there? Or?
No, it was just Donna Dresch, who ran Chainsaw, just showed an interest in our band. It's one of those things where, like, okay, if someone shows an interest, we'll do it. But it was also important to me that it was a queer label, and she put out great records, you know, like the ones that I was really into were The Need, And someone from The Need is now in a band called Nudity in Olympia, and they're really awesome. You should go check out Nudity.
I have to. I love that Need. I love those Need records.
Yeah, they're really good. And I loved being on her label, and I was, when it came time to doing our next record, she was like, "You need something bigger than Chainsaw. I don't think you should put it out with us." And then I couldn't find anyone to put it out until finally I did. The second number two record took a long time to come out, just because it was hard to find a home for it.
I guess also as you get older too, you're not as involved in these new scenes, meeting the new kids that are starting the new labels or getting, you know, in with those people. It just becomes, harder to hold on to that culture.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a social process, and I'm not that social. And so it wasn't easy for me to just meet new people and, you know, find a new home for a new record. Like what I wanted to do was just focus on making the record and focus on the songs and focus on how we sounded and playing and all the other stuff I didn't want to do. But as soon as you stop doing all that other stuff, you're dead. Like you have to do all of it. You have to find the people who will be interested in you and make sure there's a connection and hang on to it and nurture it. And by the time I realized that's what needed to be done, I just was exhausted.
That's so much energy. Doing a band's like so much fucking work.
Yeah.
Especially the starting of it. Like, I think that's the most daunting part. And I think that's why people are afraid to leave their bands after a certain point, because like you just think about, oh my gosh, the beginning is the hardest part.
Yeah. All of it is hard. Keeping it going, you know, like you finish a record, you put it out, now you got to do another one, you know. The thing that I have to, I don't know how it is for you, but for me, I just have to try to remember that it's actually the process that I love, and I'm happiest when I'm in it. And if I have to forget about whether it's successful or not, because the process is actually the happiest part.
Well, and that's the thing, is like you lose that as soon as there's other people, like labels or booking agents or managers. Like that's
for sure. No, please keep going.
I feel like there's an alienation of process that happens with that when you surrender that stuff, and like, because that stuff's the most taxing. So of course you're happy to lose that, but at the same time, when you lose touch of that thing, it's just going to change your relationship you're only going to be concerned about the success and the metrics, because that's the only thing you have to worry about.
When you finish a record, like, do you turn your back on it? Like, do you feel like, what does it feel like to you when you finish your records?
I kind of get excited at that point when I'm finished it. You know, there's obviously an immediate depression, but then there's like sort of excitement of what are people going to, like, how are people going to respond to this? Are people going to hear what I heard writing it, or what I'm trying to get across? Which is, I think that's the expectations that you start building up for yourself, which of course can never be met. And sometimes in the right way too. Like sometimes if you're like, oh, no one's going to like this, and then people do respond to it, you're like, wow, that's amazing. But it's that, you know, that's the drug, right? I guess that's the gamble. Yeah. What are your relationships like back with, you know, Heat Miser, like the last record or some of the records? Like, can you go back and listen to that stuff?
Not really. I hadn't listened to Heat Miser in, for decades. Like, I just really had to try to leave it behind in order to be able to do anything new and to get on with, you know, making something new. And it really wasn't until Tony started sending me mixes of these demos and stuff that he found, I didn't even remember that we'd done it. And I kind of couldn't believe it, because it sounded effortless, you know, like it was fun to just like, these are kids in their 20s who have so much energy and they're fucking going for it. And it sounds rad. That was fun. So putting out this record is really fun. Which is not how Heat Miser felt, you know, like, especially towards the end, it wasn't fun, but it is. So I like it.
So is it like, do you think you can go back and listen to it now with a little bit less baggage on some of the stuff? It's like, do you have a different relationship to it having gone through this project? And, you know, now, especially like, people will appreciate it in a different way. Like, there's not the same sort of pressures on it that there were before.
I don't know. I don't know. I probably will at some point. But listening to old records that I've made tends to bring out, I start deconstructing and wondering, like, why were those decisions made? And when I hear this now, with all this distance between us, I can hear things that are good, but also things that are bad. And I don't want to get paralyzed by creatively by work I don't like that I did in the past. And so I just try to avoid listening to stuff that I've made.
When Toby was on the show, like Toby Vale from Bikini Kill, she talked about how, you know, after a certain point with Nirvana, it just became a completely different world. She didn't really take in what was going on with it. Did you find that same thing with Elliott Smith's solo stuff after, you know, Either Or and everything? Like, were you able to take it in and watch it as it unfolds, or is it something that's just like completely, you're not paying attention to it?
I mean, I couldn't help but pay attention to it because it was right there. And it really changed some friendships that I had, that in a way that was confusing and discouraging, you know, like Elliott blowing up had a weird effect on some friends. I don't know how to describe it, but you know, there's that Smith song, "We hate it when our friends," what is it? "We hate it when our friends become successful or become famous." It's a weird thing, because people could think about Elliott is it was really obvious how good it was. When you're in the room listening to him, it's like, he's masterful. And like, his technical ability was exceptional. Not to say like his, and then the abundance of talent. So it was obvious that this is great. But what was weird about it for me is that it had a direct impact on my life, because it was threatening my livelihood. And it was also, he was my best friend, you know, and he didn't want it to affect me in a negative way at all. But he also needed to be the artist that he was born to be, you know, like he had to do his thing. And I understood that. So it was, I still struggle to really describe what it felt like, because it was so weird.
Yeah, I've had a couple friends, like, no, obviously not to this sort of heights, but I've had a couple friends that kind of took off, and actually a couple friends that subsequently passed away because of the stuff that was happening around them, I think, in a lot of ways. And it's interesting how they're still your friend and still someone you love deeply, but the thing that gets taken on by other people, like, you feel like, not that they're being taken away from you, but at the same time, like, there's a pulling on them in a way that, I don't know, I'm failing to kind of put into words, but I definitely relate on some level to this idea of, like, you know, I'm not a bandman with these people either, but like losing this person to this thing that, you know, isn't going to be healthy for them, because you know who they are as a person, and you know that they're not going to be something that they take to.
Yeah. Well, there's that too. Yeah, man,
Well, this has been an unbelievable conversation. And anytime you want to come on here, Neil, and talk about anything, you know, this door is always open to you.
You're amazing. You're a really generous soul. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Neil will be back for a part two at some point in the future. Sometimes you leave these conversations, or sometimes I leave these conversations with people, and they really sit with me. And this one with Neil was something that really sat with me for a very long time after having it. So, yeah, I'm grateful that I got a chance to have this conversation. I'm hopefully you enjoyed it as well, or got something out of it as well. Pick up that Heat Miser reissue on Third Man Now. Or, like, I guess it's not really a reissue. It's kind of like a greatest hits compilation type thing, but it's well worth your time to kind of investigate this band further. All right, on to the next episode of this show. Coming up on the next episode, one of the wildest episodes of this podcast I've ever done. Toronto legend, someone who's come up on this show many, many times. You can go back and listen to the John Dwyer episode. I think we talk about the Jay Riotard riot that he started another time. A person who's died twice. I remind him of this on the show. It goes wild. If you have not heard of this person, do not fear, because if you're not from Toronto, I don't know how far out this legend extends or how large this legend looms. Actually, what am I talking about? The Zoo Bombs have like a whole record named after this guy. Coming up on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, Dan Burke will be on this show. And if you are from Toronto or surrounding areas or played in Toronto, you know this is going to be a wild episode. One of the wildest episodes of the show ever. And that is on the next one. All right. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues faced by Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. Stop hate and violence towards people of different sexualities, different religions, different ethnic backgrounds, because no one should have to live in fear of hate and violence, because we're not talking about political issues. These are just basic human rights issues. People deserve to be able to live free and enjoy life. I would add to this, we got to make sure that people's rights to do what they want to do with their reproductive systems are also protected. So go out there and get involved and look at what's happening in this world. Look at organizations that could benefit from your help and your support. There's a lot of stuff in this world that is going to be very hard to change individually, but there's organizations, there's groups that are affecting positive change in this world. So get involved with your time, your money, your voice, whatever you can. And speaking about getting involved, get involved with organ donating, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. And they do perform miracles. I've seen it happen with my own eyes. It is a truly amazing thing what can be done with those organs when you're dead. Well, you're anyway, we'll get into the details now, but signing those organ donor cards. Get involved in punk, start a band, start a fanzine, a little bit different, but start a band, start a fanzine, do whatever you can, make flyers. Anyone can do this shit, and it gets better when you get involved, trust me. And try meditating. I didn't believe in it, and here I am, you know, like a fool, because I think about all the times I could have been meditating that could have been helping myself out with that kind of stuff. So try it, stick with it, and eventually it'll take. And that's it for me. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will see you on the next episode. Bye.